Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And tonight, another installment in our radio history of modern America. We can't do radio clips from the past, from earlier than the late 1920s, I guess. We have done a number of such programs recently, with me on one of them was a good old friend, Fred MacDonald, who is the senior figure in writing history of American broadcasting, both radio and television. And Fred is with us again tonight. And also with us is Matthew Ehrlich, who's got a new book titled Radio Utopia, Post-War Audio Documentary in the Public Interest. So we're going from the two programs we've done recently, which conveyed the radio history in this country, at least, of World War II. We're going to the post-war period. And that is exactly what Matthew Ehrlich's book focuses upon. And we've decided that there are some very outstanding figures, and one, surely you both agree, is Norman Corwin.
Yes, Norman Corwin was probably the premier radio dramatist of the 1930s and 1940s. The best-known work he did is probably On a Note of Triumph, which I understand has been featured on this show
before. We played a clip on the program that Fred and I did just about a few weeks ago.
And that aired when the Germans surrendered in May 1945 and expressed the hope for the war, obviously, to go on. Nobody knew how long, much longer, the war would continue, but that the war against fascism would continue, that America and the Allies would ultimately triumph, and that it would result in a better world.
And then, Fred MacDonald, after the war was over, he undertook a project that was called One World Flight. What was that?
It was a concept that grew out of a book called One World by Wendell Willkie, the Republican, the last liberal Republican nominee for the presidency, and in 1940. And they set up a foundation that commissioned this idea of bringing the world together through communication. The first award went to Willkie, Norman Corwin, and he was supposed to go around the world, which he did, and with a wire recorder, record 13 half-hour programs that CBS aired, going to different countries, looking at the world just after the war, to see, and above all, focusing on the common people. He interviewed average people more than like heads of state. It was a great concept, and what we got was an amazing show.
And what we have right here is the final installment. They used to do all programming in 13-week intervals. Is that right?
Half a season, or a third of a season, actually.
Yeah. So this is the 13th and the last broadcast, and here it is in the voice, I presume, of Norman Corwin.
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents Norman Corwin's One World Flight. There was little Jane, the English-speaking schoolgirl in the Russian broadcast.
Good morning, good morning, good morning to you. Good morning, good morning. We are glad to see you.
And the beggar song in the Chinese program. And the Maori chorus in the report from New Zealand. You have just listened to voices recorded in Russia, China, and New Zealand. Three excerpts among the hundreds heard in the course of 12 broadcasts in this unique and unprecedented CBS series, which comes to a close tonight. For this is the 13th and last program based upon Norman Corwin's recent global tour as first winner of the One World Flight Award.
This is Norman Corwin. Just as a traveler re-entering this country declares his purchases at customs, I submit for inspection in this last broadcast the main impressions of my global trip. In the 17 countries of this journey, we found things which both disheartened and encouraged, elated and dismayed us. The smoldering political dumpfires which, unheeded or deliberately fanned, could spread and envelop the earth again. Hunger and poverty, ignorance and disease lay like a smoke haze across the Middle East, India, China. The homeless slept on the sidewalks of Cairo and Nanking. The stench of decomposing corpses rose out of the sewers of Calcutta. There were pogroms in Poland, riots in Italy, bombings in Palestine, massacres in India, civil war in China and the Philippines. Against such troubles involving hundreds of millions of human beings, the hopeful things of the world may seem few and scattered, lonely and shivering and lost, but they're actually far from lost, far from hopeless. The majority of people we talked to felt that to despair of the world today is to resign from it. To assume that human nature is committed to another war is to assume that suicide is a natural remedy for our ills. A housewife in Wellington named Mrs. Jeffries had a formula for the relationship of the individual to peace and one world.
Work hard for the goodwill and the happiness of all the people nearest to you, and then increase your efforts as you get further and further out to the circumference of the circle, that circumference to be the circle of the globe. And I think that if each individual every day and in every way works sincerely and hard and unflinchingly towards that end, and then prays hard for that ideal, I think it might come.
The informed and articulate people of the earth, of whom Mrs. Jeffries is representative, have a conscience and a will. The will is to be free and peaceful in a single world, to resist corruption and to make none of the old mistakes anew. Nobody wants ever to awake in the night again and hear the sound of careless politics raining down on them. These sounds of indiscriminate warfare are obsolete today, not because man has pledged himself to be less inhuman to man, but only because there are far deadlier weapons. Yet, perhaps all such sounds can be banished forever if each of us is willing to assist in the mammoth task of preserving the peace, if each of us is willing to accept his share in what is far and away the greatest challenge of our lives and the greatest opportunity of our time, the making of one world.
Well, fascinating material, isn't it?
Very much is. But what you see and what you hear in this particular cut is a very important moment in American history. The quantitative problems seem to have been solved. The Depression is over. You've got relocation coming as a problem, but that will be solvable. War has been solved. And now that the quantitative has been controlled, it's time now in the minds of many of the national leaders, especially liberals, that we need a qualitative change. We need to make radio more uplifting, more intelligent, more informative. And this, the book, is all about that period.
Yes, and it was the idea that radio had shown what it could do for the world, for America specifically, during a time of war. And now, purportedly, Admiral actually said this, it was time to show what radio could do for the nation and the world in a time of peace.
An interesting side note about the man, Corwin. He was, of course, also a great writer. He wrote radio drama and undoubtedly did it in a very exciting and inventive way, which was imitated by many others later on. One of the most amazing things is that he is still with us at the age of, what, 101?
Yes.
And you just told me before we went, or maybe when we started playing that, that his brother... Older brother recently died at 106, yes. And his father died as a centenarian.
Something
as well.
Like 110. 110. So some remarkable genes at work there.
Well, I wonder whether he's still broadcasting.
He was professor at University of Southern California well into his 80s.
The 90s, actually.
90s?
Yes.
Yeah. I looked at a clip on YouTube, a video interview that somebody did with him, in which he's very compos mentis, though he's looking a little worn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure when that was done.
And there was a very good documentary, short subject, that was done on Corwin. Was that the Gene Siskel Theater about 2 or 3 years ago?
It won the Oscar.
It did?
Oh. Yes.
And that's only the beginning. Many other interesting clips of that sort to come, but we are, of course, somewhat overdue for commercials. Here they are.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Two radio historians are my guest tonight, and lots of radio performers via sound clips. Those two radio historians are our old friend, Fred McDonald, and a new one, Matthew Ehrlich. Fred took an early retirement as a professor of history at Northeastern Illinois University, maintained a vast radio, television, movie archive for many, many years, which was used by many people, and only recently all of that was turned over to the Library of Congress.
That's right. In December, they took all of our assets.
You're a man without an archive.
But a building. I have an empty building.
Yes. And Matthew Ehrlich is professor in the Department of, rather, the School of Communications.
Department of Journalism in the College of Media at the University
That's
of Illinois.
That's the way we say it. At the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And someplace along the line, somebody invented a word, docudrama. What does that mean?
Well, what we were just listening to, the One World Flight, was one of the first uses of actualities. That's a radio term for recorded quotes. But really up until then, 1946, 1947, most of what was called documentary on radio was, in fact, what we would today consider docudrama, in that they didn't use recordings. There was, in fact, a recording ban on both CBS and NBC for many, many years, and the recording technology for field recordings was very clumsy and hard to use. So when you did a documentary, quote-unquote, you were using actors, sound effects, live orchestras, and actors playing the parts of real people.
Mm-hmm. That was, Fred, am I right? Was that begun by a program that actually was pre-war in the 1930s? I've heard clips of it, wonderfully, almost surreally, super dramatic, called The March of Time.
It was. The March of Time began on radio as an outgrowth of Time magazine.
Ah,
and in 1931, with actors portraying historical characters. Orson Welles was one of the actors on there for years. And they would, if they're going to report on something that the Italian army did, there would be somebody playing Mussolini, somebody playing a Spanish loyalist. And that's how they brought the news in a dramatic fashion. And that kind of approach is still very popular. In fact, it's growing now in modern television because they don't want to buy the clips of the real thing, or they can't find the clips of the real event, so they hire actors to portray the historical characters.
Now, back to radio-recorded material at hand and to be played on this program tonight. And the next one up, is this from your collection, Fred?
Yes.
An open letter on race hatred. Explain.
A monumental program from July of 1943. It followed a month after the disastrous race riots that ripped through Detroit, Michigan, and caused all sorts of deaths and loss of manpower. We're fighting a war, and at home we're tearing each other apart over race. Well, this is a program written and produced by...
William Robeson.
Oh yeah, William N. Robeson. One of the great radio behind-the-scene people. And it has actors and great dramatic narration and live music in the studio. And this is what it sounded like.
Dear fellow Americans, what you are about to hear may anger you. What you are about to hear may sound incredible to you. You may doubt that such things can happen today in this supposedly united nation. But we assure you, everything you are about to hear is true. And so we ask you to spend 30 minutes with us, facing quietly and without passion or prejudice a danger which threatens all of us. A danger so great that if it is not met and conquered now, even though we win this war, we shall be defeated in victory. And the peace which follows will for us be a horror of chaos, lawlessness, and bloodshed. This danger is race hatred. Tonight, race hatred is breeding and festering in a score of booming, overcrowded war centers. And so tonight, we ask you to hear what happened in Detroit, because we believe that no sensible, fully informed American will allow to happen again, here at home, what he is fighting against all over the world. Sunday, June 20th, was hot. Detroit, sprawling across the flat Michigan prairie, baked in the nearly vertical sun. In the workers' camps on the fringe of the city, trailers and tents held the heat close and unbreathable. In the crowded flats and overflowing houses along Tireman and Epworth Boulevard in the Negro District, the heat pressed down like the sweaty hand of John Henry. The Poles and Hamtramck felt it. And the 2 and 3 families crammed into one family apartments. Their tempers grew shorter as the day lengthened from one hot hour to another. Those who could find any way to get there headed for lovely Belle Isle in the Detroit River and a breath of fresh air. But when the flat, hot sun dropped into the lake on the other side of Michigan, the twilight brought little relief. And still sweating, tempers shortened even more, they started home to another sticky, sleepless night. The traffic moved slowly across the bridge from Belle Isle, cars creeping bumper to bumper, the crowds on foot filling the sidewalk. Something happened there. No one is quite sure what. But something happened that hot Sunday last month. Something in itself trivial. Something like this.
Faster by blowing the horn.
If that guy ahead will just move forward, I can get into the other line.
Oh, Eddie, don't
shut up, shut up. There, now I got a break. Did you see that? He pulled out right in front of me. Hey, you stupid jerk.
That's a big idea, bud.
Oh, a Negro,
no,
huh? Listen, you, get out of that car and I'll show you. You black punk.
Eddie, please.
I'll show him. What's the idea, brother?
You know how crowds are. Nothing like a good fight. You push up as close as you can and you get pushed. And it's usually all in good fun. But this crowd was tired and hot and full of deep-seated grievances that June evening. It promptly took sides, and taking sides, broke up into other fights. And those out on the edge couldn't tell what was going on.
Well, that is something. I've never heard that before. I do remember reading about that race riot. It was a riot in which quite a number of people were killed, I believe.
Yes, and at the end of that program, Wendell Willkie actually comes on and makes about a 4-minute plea for racial sanity in this country, you know, saying we're fighting an enemy on both fronts and you're tearing each other's throats out.
There's also concerns about it airing in the South, and so they did closed-circuit broadcasts before it aired or just to the Southern affiliates to make sure that there wouldn't be too much dissent among the stations down
there. And was
there.
It blacked out in some of the Southern cities?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. Fascinating. We are due for an update on the news, and we go on directly after that with many more illustrations from the docudrama period and these social concerns period in the history of American radio. When we return after the update on the news from David Jennings.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
The text for tonight's program is given in the work, the new book, by Matthew Ehrlich, who's one of our guests. the title Radio Utopia, Post-War Audio Documentary in the Public Interest, and that is published by the University of Illinois Press. Our other guest is a cherished old friend, Fred McDonald, whose many books dealing with the history of broadcasting are, most of them, I'm sure, still in print. Was the one on radio, Don't Touch That Dial, the first of them?
Yes, 1979.
And then you wrote...
Blacks and White TV, Television and the Red Menace, Who Shot the Sheriff, The Rise and Fall of the Western. I edited Richard Durham's Destination Freedom, which was a wonderful Chicago drama show in the late 40s, One Nation Under Television. And then I wrote The History Shop, The Code of Clio, and most recently, I, Liberal.
Which is available on your website.
No, it's available. All the other ones except I, Liberal are free on my website, and they're all filled with radio shows and films, jfredmacdonald.com. But the iLiberal is available only on Kindle or Nook.
And it is a devastating critique of contemporary conservatism. And despite the fact that we are old friends, I choose not to discuss that with you because it would produce a tension that neither of us wants.
Okay. Those are the ground rules. I'll accept
them. I think so. Well, at least while we're on the air tonight. And back to the playlist. The next one up is from a program titled Eagle's Brood. The writer was a guy named Robert Cheyenne, who figures quite prominently also in your book, doesn't he?
Yes, Robert Louis Cheyenne was a contemporary of William Robeson, who wrote Open Letter on Race Hatred, which we were hearing a little bit earlier. Not a journalist, a radio dramatist. He wrote plays during the war, boosting the war effort. And Edward R. Murrow, who became a CBS vice president right after the war for a short period, picked Cheyenne to be part of the new CBS documentary unit that was intended to do programs on serious public issues, and one of them happened to be juvenile delinquency. And so Robert Louis Cheyenne was sent around the country on a several weeks trip to investigate the conditions underlying delinquency. He ends up here in Chicago, speaks with Saul Alinsky and about neighborhood organizing and people's councils, so-called, and then puts together a dramatized docudrama program called The Eagle's Brood, with, again, sound effects and live orchestra and actors playing the part of real people, including Joseph Cotten.
Joseph Cotten is one of the voices we're about to hear in this brief excerpt.
Yes.
Here it is.
I was on a train heading west. I'd been to the deep south. I lay in my berth and watched the darkness go by. I thought of Henderson on the prison farm. I thought of the teacher and the four boys, the sheriff and the judge. I thought of Mason. Mason had cared. He had yelled. He had tried to do things.
Juvenile delinquency? Brother, you've come to the right town. I know. I was born here.
Mason was young, clean cut. He'd been in the Navy. Wore a smart gray tweed suit. He was the college instructor type. Soft-spoken, direct, honest. He was a reporter.
We're down to Shantytown. Take a look at the shacks owned by wealthy, respectable citizens. They rent them for $2-3 a week. Whole families live in them in one room with chickens and dogs and no plumbing. They're building a housing project on the edge of a garbage dump. Flies get in the milk. The smoke of the burning garbage gets into the school windows. The kids scavenge for half-open boxes of raisins. Our city offers itself to tourists. But what has it got to offer its own people? The average citizen doesn't care. He isn't interested.
What about the juvenile court?
The judge is a politician. He's running for re-election. He's got no background, no training, but he's the machine candidate, so he'll probably get in again. He's been on the bench for years. He plays God with children's lives for votes. Come election time, there are judges that send out word to the cops not to make any juvenile arrests. It's bad for the record. That's the lowdown. You can have it. I'm through with the newspaper racket. What's the good of yelling? Nobody listens. I'm getting me a job as a publicity director for a cotton firm. Fight for civic change? Don't make me laugh.
The hotel room we had talked in was on the second floor. It looked over the main street. White banners with red feathers swung in the breeze outside, lighted up by rows of electric bulbs. It was community chess campaign time. The posters in the smart shop windows showed a blonde kid in a torn sweater with an underprivileged look rising out of a big fist. The slogan read, He's in your hand.
What begins to become very apparent, even if one hadn't read your book, and I've been reading the book, but all of this is illustrative of one of your major points in Radio Utopia, that a whole load of social issues, social problems that persisted, that emerged during the war maybe, and certainly persisted after the war, become the basic focus of these docudramas. It's as if radio has sort of discovered trouble in America that needs to be worked through, somehow resolved, and it now presumes to do the job.
Yes, and so juvenile delinquency,
racism,
a venereal disease, which was extremely taboo on American mm-hmm. broadcasting immediately after the war, became a subject of an ABC documentary. ABC was the old NBC Blue network, and because it didn't have nearly the audience of CBS and NBC, was willing to take chances, and also to get publicity. So they did programs on subjects like that.
Some of the people who did this kind of radio, who wrote and or acted, but particularly the writers, including, I think, even Corwin, were brought under the veil of suspicion by perhaps even the House Un-American Activities Committee, if it had started that early. At any rate, there were accusations that these are communist dupes or secret members of the Communist Party.
Well, you had a situation as the Cold War begins to set in by 48-ish, especially after the Berlin blockade. The notion that any kind of change could be being instituted by communists. And if you were against reform, if you were a white Democratic senator from the South and your constituents wanted to keep apartheid, you could simply say any kind of attempt to change the racial balance in America, that's a communist plot. So all of a sudden, there's opposition to reform. And American politics begins to retard this movement that Professor Ehrlich writes about. And indeed, by the early 50s, it has really tied everything up. And it pretty much stops until the Supreme Court rules in 1954 on the Brown case that separate but equal is inherently unequal.
But something else, of course, happens that may put an end to this phase in American radio, namely another great communications medium, which had been invented and developed even before the war, but was put on the back burner because of the war, now finally takes off, that being television.
Yes, World War II was wonderful for radio. At the end of the war, radio was obviously the preeminent broadcast medium, and television was very much an afterthought in everyone's mind, except perhaps network executives who knew they had a gold mine on their hands. So it happens very quickly, just as we were discussing about 1948, the political mood has shifted appreciably. Television by 1948 has come very much to the fore and is now a national medium and is starting to supplant radio.
As early as 48?
Yes.
But the television networks, I think, don't really get fully established till later, because wasn't there something about running them on a coaxial cable across the country?
Well, the idea of being able to see a program that is put on in New York City, to be able to see it in Chicago, was accomplished in January of 49 when the coaxial cable
was
up. But then you couldn't see it live in Los Angeles because the cable hadn't gotten that far yet. So they relied on what they call kinescopes, which were 16-millimeter uh-huh. films that were shot from a naked television screen, sound and picture, and then those were shopped or bicycled around, as they say, to stations in North Dakota, California.
And I would bet that at your great archive, now at the Library of Congress, you had loads of kinescopes.
We had lots of kinescopes because they became permanent records of what was on television.
But radio docudrama took on the question of what will television do to us? And the next excerpt we're going to play, right after we pause for some commercials, is illustrative of that. Directly back to Matthew Ehrlich and to Fred MacDonald, and more great stuff from the period in American radio running roughly from 45 to 55. First, these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are focused on a period in the history of radio in this country, and radio is reflecting major themes in the history of the United States during those years. Much concern about rampant and continuing social problems that need to be addressed. And radio takes a very strong lead in calling those problems to the public's attention, if only for those few years, roughly from 45 to 55. Television in some part takes over. There are other reasons that the concerns of radio kind of shift in other directions. But let's go directly back to that period. And next up is NBC's answer to CBS, you were saying.
Yes, a program called Living 1948. CBS had gotten a lot of attention, a lot of goodwill from its programs, which it promoted very heavily. ABC had gotten a lot of attention for its documentaries, and so had Mutual. And so people were looking at NBC, which was the number one network at that time, and saying, well, when are they going to jump on the bandwagon? So Living 1948 was in part a competitive response to that. Again, a docudrama series on a variety of issues that were affecting the nation, employing actors, with Ben Grauer, who's the voice of the NBC Symphony Orchestra, as the announcer.
But the clip we've got from Living 1948, and there were also Living 1949, 1950, 1951,
mm-hmm.
is that right?
Yeah.
This clip is about television. And it's titled Many Happy Returns. This is from November 1948. I haven't heard this. I'm not quite sure what they do with it. Let's find out.
William, will you give the present tense of the verb videre?
Yes, ma'am. Video, I see. Vides, you see. Videt, he sees. Videmus, we all see.
Videmus, we all see. Fewer than 8,000 Americans saw the last presidential inauguration. This coming January, exactly 4 years afterward, at least 1 million persons will simultaneously see our newly elected president inaugurated. More than saw Lincoln during his entire term in the White House. This miracle will be performed by television, by video.
Videmus, we all see.
Living 1948, noting the fact that this is Radio Week, today honors the 25th anniversary of the invention of the iconoscope, the electron tube that added sight to radio's sound, and holds up its radio mirror to reflect the possible future impact upon society, inherent in still another mirror, television, in a drama document entitled
Television, Many Happy Returns.
Once again, here is your narrator, Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. Back in the 20s, a man with a name that rings on the tongue,
Vladimir Kosma Zvorykin,
entered the presence of David Sarnoff, president of the Radio Corporation of America, carrying a radically designed cathode ray tube. He said, in effect,
this, Mr. Sarnoff, is an electronic eye for television. With this, the mechanical scanner with which others have been experimenting is no longer needed. Quietly, like your own eye, it will see what you wish to see.
For a half hour, the two men talked. The scientist and the man since called the father of television talked quite simply, not at all in the manner with which writers would dramatize the significant historical event unfolding. The one says,
it's too good to be true. What will it cost to develop the idea?
Hesitantly, the other replies,
maybe $100,000?
And the answer comes back. An answer that was destined to touch your life and mine and millions like us.
All right.
It's worth it. Thus was television's eye born 25 years ago. And like any child full of promise, launched upon its way, bearing its self-descriptive name.
Icon, Latin for image, scope for observe. Iconoscope, to observe the image.
Along with the kinescope or picture tube, which reproduced what the...
You know, I'd like to hear the rest of that, as so would lots of our listeners. With regard to all of these excerpts we're playing tonight, where are they or are they available for public consumption?
Well, I think they're in Fred's archive. That's now part of the Library of Congress, a lot of them.
A lot of them. Some of them are in the books that are up on my website, or if you're reading the book, it'll actually have a link. We put the actual radio shows up. I think this one... No, this one's not there.
But you have these. You have so many sites that are you find under the rubric old time radio. Would you find this kind of material there as well?
A lot of the living 1948, 49, et cetera, programs are.
If you entered it on Google search and just said living 1948 TV, would that recover some of it?
I would believe it would, yeah.
From my experiences, the guys that put those up want to sell Fibber McGee and Molly, Jack Benny Show, the entertainment, and they don't do much with the news programming except maybe World War II D-Day landings. And so if it's up there, it's because he's Professor Ehrlich's found it there, but I've never found it there.
And there are websites that have a lot of, if you pay a certain amount of money, usually not that much money, you have downloads that you can get of the MP3 clips.
Now, I'm going to give you something I downloaded today. This is my contribution with regard to all the clips that we're playing, namely Ed Murrow, famous figure. We've played Murrow doing World War II reportage, but Murrow after the war is doing docudrama and also direct commentary on very important issues, and a famous issue emerges, his critique of Senator Joe McCarthy. I want to work this all in before we have to stop for on our newscast. Therefore, here is an excerpt from one of his attacks on Senator McCarthy and McCarthy's response.
Tonight, See It Now devotes its entire half hour to a report on Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, told mainly in his own words and pictures. Our working thesis tonight is this quotation. If this fight against communism is made a fight between America's two great political parties, the American people know that one of these parties will be destroyed, and the Republic cannot endure very long as a one-party system. We applaud that statement. And we think Senator McCarthy ought to. He said it 17 months ago in Milwaukee.
The American people realize that this cannot be made a fight between America's two great political parties. If this fight against communism is made a fight between America's two great political parties, the American people know that one of those parties will be destroyed and the Republic can't endure very long as a one-party system.
Now, a sample of an investigation. The witness was Reed Harris. For many years, a civil servant in the State Department, directing the Information Service. Harris was accused of helping the communistic cause by curtailing some broadcasts to Israel.
You attended Columbia University in the early 30s.
I did, Mr. Chairman.
Would you speak a little louder, sir?
I did, Mr. Chairman.
And were you expelled from Columbia?
I was suspended from classes on April 1st, 1932. I was later reinstated. And I resigned from the university.
And you resigned from the university. Did the Civil Liberties Union provide you with an attorney at that time?
I had many offers of attorneys, and one of those was from the American Civil Liberties Union, yes.
The question is, did the Civil Liberties Union supply you with an attorney?
They did supply an attorney.
The answer is yes?
The answer is yes.
You know, the Civil Liberties Union has been listed as a front for and doing the work of the Communist Party.
Mr. Chairman, this was 1932.
Right. Yeah, I know this was 1932. Do you know that they since have been listed as a front for and doing the work of the Communist Party?
I do not know that they have been listed so, sir.
You don't know that they have been listed?
I have heard that mention or read that mention.
The Reed-Harris hearing demonstrates one of the senator's techniques. Twice, he said the American Civil Liberties Union was listed as a subversive front. The Attorney General's list does not and has never listed the ACLU as subversive, nor does the FBI or any other federal government agency. And the American Civil Liberties Union holds in its files letters of commendation from President Truman, President Eisenhower, and General MacArthur.
Interesting to hear that. Now, of course, that's from a TV series called See It Now, but that was preceded by a radio thing called
Hear It Now.
Hear It Now.
Which was named after the Columbia record history called I Can Hear It Now that came out in 1948 about the Depression and War Years.
More about Murrow, his career and his own broadcasting and the people that he brought into broadcasting.
Well, he is really the first modern broadcast journalist. He begins with CBS in the mid-1930s. He becomes most famous for his coverage of the Blitz in London in 1940, and develops a whole coterie of sidekicks, who they used to call Murrow's Men. And they are the cream of the CBS crop. You've got Eric Severide, you've got Richard Hodlett, you've got
Howard K. Smith, William Shirer.
And these are guys who were stationed in Europe covering the war, as he was stationed in London, Shirer's in Berlin, Severide was in Paris, and they would broadcast the latest news by shortwave every night in 1939 and 40.
But then his post-war career still becomes a very central presence in American broadcasting.
Yes.
Radio first, then television.
Yes, he is a CBS executive and has an influence shaping CBS documentary program, including some of the stuff that we've been listening to earlier, and then moves back as a commentator and with Fred Friendly does Hear It Now, which is only on the air for about 6 months, but really establishes the template for See It Now, which is that very famous series.
And Friendly and Murrow are pictured on the cover of your book, Radio Utopia. And as I told you, looking at that picture reminded me that Fred Friendly appeared on this program once. It would have been after 1985, because I do remember him sitting in this studio, and that's when we moved over here. He had done a book about press freedom and its infringement, and I guess that was the last book he did, or maybe the only book he did, but a very interesting man who had himself great influence upon American broadcasting. We are late for an update on the news, and then we shall return. But right now to the WGN Newsroom and David Jennings.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to our two guests of the evening, Matthew Ehrlich and Fred McDonald. The book that we're featuring tonight is the book by by Matthew Ehrlich, published quite recently, I gather.
Yes, this year.
Titled Radio Utopia, Postwar Audio Documentary in the Public Interest. And that's one book in a series, I gather, titled The History of Communication.
Yes, it is.
Published by University of Illinois Press. We need to talk about about actuality, as it used to be called, as it's still called, as a matter of fact, in broadcasting elsewhere. Actualité is a word still used in French broadcasting. We're about to go to one of the great actuality programs, though I think it was originally used in American radio and television, it has since gone into disuse. I don't know what word. Docudrama is another word that we don't really use it anymore. I don't know. If they were doing You Are There or CBS Is There as a radio program still, as they did do starting in what year, 1947,
yes.
If they were still doing it, what would we call that sort of program?
Well, back then, it was actually at the end of its run, produced by the CBS documentary unit. You know, back then, again, documentary had a very fluid meaning. And actuality in radio typically refers to recordings. And CBS Is There, which became You Are There, was actually done all live in the studio.
The concept is a fascinating one. And you say it was developed by, what was his name? Goodman
Ace.
Goodman Ace. We used to have his own daily 15-minute funny show.
With his wife, Jane. They were called Easy Aces.
Easy Aces.
Starting in the early 1930s, and it was filled with masterful puns and great humor. Just a banter between the man and wife. But it was his idea. Then it was developed by the writer we've already heard about, Robert Louis Cheyenne. And the idea was to use real CBS newsmen, not newswomen, because there were no newswomen of any amount, and use these newsmen and put them back in historical situations and have them interview. It might be Washington getting ready to cross the Delaware to invade Trenton.
The one assumption is is radio is present throughout human history.
Right, exactly. We can go back as far as Socrates.
Which they did, apparently.
They did Socrates, yeah. They did Alexander the Great.
And here we have, I gather, the very first program in that series.
Which is the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. So the first thing you're going to hear is John Daly as the CBS reporter who's actually inside Ford's Theater with Don Hollenbeck.
Wonderful. Here it is.
Mr. Lincoln is just plain enjoying himself tonight, for the president is listening with obvious pleasure to Mrs. Mount Chessington, an English lady in the cast, and Harry Hawke, who is playing Asa Trencher, the American cousin. Now, once again, our microphones on the stage pick up the play.
Don't know the manners of good society, eh? Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, old gal. You sock-dologizing old man trap.
What was that? It sounded like a shot, but there's no shot in the play. One moment. Oh, Major Rathbone is struggling with a man in Mr. Lincoln's box. A man who is stabbing wildly at him with a knife. Major Rathbone's giving ground before that knife, and now his attacker has leapt over the railing. He's on the stage. The man has risen. He's running across the stage. He's gone through the stage, exit directly under this box. That was Major Rathbone who shouted out, "Stop that man." Someone in the audience has leapt over the footlights after him. Something has happened. Something is terribly wrong. This is not part of the play. Blue smoke is curling from President Lincoln's box. I can't see him because Miss Harris and the Major and Mrs. Lincoln are surrounding him. President Lincoln has been shot. That was Mrs. Lincoln who just cried out, "He has shot Mr. Lincoln." The man did it. The man who ran across the stage. The man who grappled with the Major. John Hollenbeck is out there in the theater, already fighting his way up to the president's truck. So go ahead, Hollenbeck.
John Hollenbeck, I guess we're on the air here. I'm trying to get through this crowd to find out what's going on. I don't know what's happened. I don't know what's happened.
What is it? What's happened? Tell me what's happened.
Someone has shot Mr. Lincoln.
It was Boone.
Who? Don't let go. A member of the crowd has identified Mr. Lincoln. He says it was Booth, the actor, John Wilkes Booth. We'll try to get someone who was in or near Mr. Lincoln's spot.
Now, the full horror of what has just happened at Ford Theater is beginning to dawn. We will stay here in front of the Peterson House and bring you immediately any reports on Mr. Lincoln's condition. But we have just been informed that something has happened elsewhere in Washington that we don't know of here on the scene, and so we return you now to our studio.
And I'll give you the bulletins as fast as they come in, Quincy, as soon as we get it back from Daly down there on the street, right?
How much time have I got, though? How long have
we
been on?
Wait a minute. Go ahead.
You're on the air. This is Quincy Howe. John Daly has just announced that an attempt has been made on the life of Abraham Lincoln at Ford Theater. Secretary of State Seward, has also... just a second. Here's the bulletin. Secretary of State Seward has been attacked. A man entered the Seward House on Lafayette Square in Washington tonight. He overpowered all resistance, gained entrance to the secretary's bedroom, and slashed at Mr. Seward with a knife. It's not known whether the attacker was John Wilkes Booth or an accomplice, or whether the two attacks were connected. Now here's Ned Calmer with more bulletins. All Washington's in a state of panic this terrible night of April 14th, 1865. There are wild rumors that the entire cabinet has been murdered, that General Grant has been assassinated, that the war is not yet over. There's no evidence as yet that these other wild rumors are true. I repeat, the other rumors are not true so far as is known. Secretary of War Stanton...
The tragic news of the attack on President Lincoln has spread around the world. And now CBS takes you to important European capitals.
This is St. Petersburg, Russia. I will read a message from Leo Tolstoy, our great Russian author. The greatness of Napoleon, Caesar, or Washington is moonlight by the sun of Lincoln. His example is universal and will last thousands of years. Lincoln is humanity. We return you now to the United States.
Secretary of War Stanton is coming out of the Peterson House now. He pauses in the doorway, and the crowd, looking at his grief-stricken face, is suddenly silent. Mr. Stanton, how is Mr. Lincoln?
No,
She belongs to the ages. The dread thing that we have awaited is come. President Lincoln is dead. The victim of Booth's vicious...
Washington, April 14, 1865. Abraham Lincoln is assassinated at Ford's Theater.
These ran as half-hour programs, did they?
Yes.
So what was the rest of this one?
The rest of which?
Of this particular program. We've only heard about five.
Well, that was those were excerpts, and that's actually how the program did end.
Oh, I see. So excerpts tells, yeah. Put together to give you a briefer image of the total program.
Yeah.
Fascinating technique. Would Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, done in 1938, have given them sort of a template for this kind of thing?
Well, it gave them a warning to make sure that you let people know if you're making these sort of fictional news events, to let them know that this is a fictionalization. This is not happening. Don't think the Martians have invaded. Don't run out in a panic. And actually, the FCC encouraged them to so notify their listeners from then on.
But if you've heard the War of the Worlds broadcast and then you listen to what we just heard, you can hear a lot of similarities to the person supposedly not knowing he's on the air, and the use of shortwave techniques. I know that last week you were doing Edward R. Murrow's famous Buchenwald broadcast with the shortwave interference. And so you have shortwave broadcasts purportedly coming from Russia with Tolstoy, and they had one from Queen Victoria. So they were using the same kinds of things that Orson Welles had done several years earlier.
And they covered history from...
the whole span of recorded history back to ancient times, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, and they had a fictional CBS reporter who was covered in molten lava and killed, supposedly.
Goodness.
But most of the real-life CBS reporters of that day, or at least a great many of them, as we just heard,
performed,
did participate in the program, except for Ed Murrow, who did not want to participate.
I would certainly love to get my hands on many of these, if they are available in any way, are they?
They must be available, because in the collection we sent to the Library of Congress, I probably had 50 of them.
Yeah.
As well as another 60 on film, but 50 radio versions. They did them radio and, of course, on
television.
Really great
stuff. And we're terribly late for some commercials, so here they are.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And now we're coming to local broadcasting, to Chicago.
That's one thing to remember, is that we've been talking about national network broadcasting. We haven't even said the word mutual, but the mutual network also contributed to this examination of America in the post-war years. But on the local level, local stations were doing much of the same thing. And one of the important sub-themes of it all is the rise of technological quality in this kind of reporting. We heard at the very beginning of the show the wire recorder. Well, other tape recording developments came along, plastic tape, the regular tape we now know. Early on, for instance, on the local level in Chicago, WMAQ would send a van out to a news scene and they would interview people on tape there, because they couldn't do it otherwise. It was a big contraption. Then they would come back to the studio, and because of union rules, trying to protect the jobs of people before the tape recorder, they would have to transfer it to a recording disc, like a big record, and they would play it from the record. Now, by 1955, in the next cut we're going to listen to, we have developed not only audio tape recording, but portable tape recorders that you can strap on your back, hold out the microphone, and get the sound. You still had to come back and put it on a record, and if you couldn't, we'd never be able to hear this. But we're going to hear a cut with John Chancellor, who later becomes the anchor of the NBC Network News on in the 1970s. We're going to hear him as a local reporter on WMAQ, the NBC radio station, out in the field in a dramatic scene with a shootout with a wanted criminal, murderer suspect, with Chicago police, and they capture him, and he is breathless, and the sound, the actuality sound we hear is stunning. This is what radio news has now reached.
And this is This is not replayed, not dramatized. This is
no dramatization. This is the actual shootout.
This is really you are there.
Yes.
Front of 2048 Potomac. They have him up there now. The police are all crouched behind the cars. You can hear them firing at him now. Is he on the roof or is he in the building? He's in the third floor of the building. Is it Carpenter? It's Carpenter. Time is 11 minutes after 9.
They've got him.
They've got him. Have you got him?
Yeah.
Who got him? Did he walk out the door?
I don't know.
They've got him. The time is 12 minutes after 9. They've got him. They're bringing him out now. They're taking him out now. Get out of the way, will you? Get out of the way. Thick in the air. There's tear gas in the air. There's a terrific crowd around him. The police are trying to make a cordon around this man while they lead him away. The street is full of people. The police are walking here. I'm next to an officer with a submachine gun pointed in the air. Ahead of me, about 15 feet, listen to the loudspeaker. They're saying, everybody fall back. Who got him? Did they go in and get him?
I couldn't tell you.
But they've got him, definitely. We don't know yet how. But put him in the squad, they said. Get back.
Back up there. Come on, don't crowd us too far.
Crowd around him. They're looking for handcuffs now. The handcuff. He's cuffed now. Say, who got him? Do you know?
There's a number of us. Couldn't say.
Did somebody go in there after him?
Oh, there were quite a few.
What have you got? His foot?
I got him by the sheet of his face.
You got... An unbelievable crowd around our NBC microphone now. They're calling for the wagon.
Put him in a car.
They're just trying to get him out of the neighborhood before any more trouble happens. They're just trying to get him out of here now. I hope this recorder is working.
I hope this recorder is working. It's a great last line.
Yes, I think everybody who's ever used a recorder or even a camera always hopes that it worked.
One of the first times I ever did a radio interview was for the University of Chicago, talking to a congressman. I forget his name now, but he was important for a while. And we went down to the hotel in downtown Chicago. And the guy who came along as the engineer set up to do a tape recording. And we did a full hour, which I thought was pretty good. I was just starting to do this program called Conversations at Chicago, which they used to send out around the country in tape form to be played on other stations as a freebie. And as we were driving back, the man who was the engineer, or was filling in as the engineer, said, "Boy, I'm glad that he didn't catch on." I said, "To what?" He said, "Well, the machine wasn't working." I almost killed the guy because I really felt I had done something exceptional. I was still quite new at interviewing for radio.
Well, that's always been a case with recordings, like that Norman Corwin series, One World Flight. They were using a wire recorder, which was gigantic, and literally recorded on a spool of wire about as thick around as a human hair.
Really?
And if it broke, you had to take a lit cigarette and fuse it together. And he's trying to do these interviews around the world, and the machine keeps failing.
Oh, my.
So the technology really does start to become wonderful in many ways and also a burden in some ways.
Because, Matthew, you are not only a professor of journalism at the University of Illinois, you have been a broadcaster down there on the university station, WILL.
Yes, I was on WILL radio, and I did radio stories, and the recorder sometimes did not work.
Well, we are about to pause for another update on the news, but it is time now certainly also to invite listeners to call in to raise questions, for that matter, to share memories, or otherwise to offer profound thought. 312-591-7200, the number as ever, 312-591-7200. The lines are open at this instant. If you want to get in there quickly, just give us a ring. We'll be with you shortly. If you want to reach us via email, particularly that is appropriate for our internet listeners at some greater distance, then the email address is, of course, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at WGNradio.com, and for phones 312-591-7200. To the WGN Newsroom now, and David Jennings.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And as we're examining radio from the period immediately in the post-war years, 45 forward perhaps to 55, one more local one. Fred, this is from your collection as well, is it?
Yes.
Blueprint for Survival. What was that?
That was a 13-part series that WMAQ did in 1951 about how to survive atomic warfare. The Cold War was in. The fear of Russian attacking America was very palpable.
That's when in kindergarten they were having the kids practice by hiding under desks.
Duck and cover.
While you imitated or mimicked a nuclear attack.
Exactly. And this is one here where they're talking about all forms of warfare that the Russians were going to possibly pull on us. And this particular excerpt deals with biological warfare.
Now, is this real discussion by experts, or is this more docudrama?
This is docudrama, but it illustrates that on the local level, as I said earlier, the local stations were doing similar programs. They do series on medical problems. They do series on the state of health of America, mm-hmm. on drunk driving and alcoholism. Multiple programs on it, but do it in dramatized fashion. Here it's the war and the potential for atomic warfare or other forms of death from international rivalry.
So a local broadcast from September 1951.
Blueprint for Survival. WMAQ brings you Blueprint for Survival, presenting tonight the ninth in a series of 13 programs designed to help you and to help your country survive in this atomic age. Biological warfare. Yes, it's a grim threat, but it's no secret superweapon. We've heard some strange things about it. We've heard stories of mysterious new diseases that could kill millions and attacks that could wipe out entire cities. Unfortunately, a lot of us believe these stories. Take my friend Fred Barnes, for instance. Oh, Fred's pretty well cured by now, but I can remember when he wasn't. In fact, I can remember one day just last month. We were talking about the poisoned bread epidemic that was panicking the people of Pont-Saint-Esprit in France at the time.
Yeah, can you imagine? One fouled up bag of flour poisoned over 200 people and killed four of them.
They said it was caused by some kind of fungus, didn't they?
Yes, Helen, a fungus called ergot.
I wouldn't be surprised if the Russians were experimenting with that ergot stuff right now.
Experimenting? What for?
What for? So they could use it against us. So their saboteurs could mix it in with other flours over here and poison us.
Biological warfare, hmm?
Sure. If they're going to use germs against us, they might as well throw in this fungus, too. Anything to knock us off.
You know something? I'm not very sure I like living in the 20th century.
That is interesting. It's docudrama. Sounds just as if it might have been done on a network. It's well done.
You set up a little drama, and you weave in information that is real or that comes from the current political situation.
What was WGN doing along those lines at that time? Does anybody here know?
I really don't.
I should have dipped into the WGN files to find something comparable.
I wish I did know. I don't, I'm afraid.
The WGN by that time was not doing this kind of network programming. It was I think it was switching over even earlier than the main network stations to do music and talk and these kinds of ventures that eventually all of AM radio will gravitate toward.
We're about to take some phone calls. 312-591-7200. If you've got something you want to say or ask, get in there quickly. We've got some space available on the board. 312-591-7200. And Joe is first up. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes.
Great, great show as always. Always intelligent. The best on radio.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. Now, I remember the last take was about, you said something about alcoholism. I remember when I was a kid on the radio, before we had TV, hearing those advertisements about alcohol, and, you know, that seemed to be always, and that commercial, that take that you played. And then my question is, the first take that you played about the shootout, why was the crowd screaming, yelling?
You can imagine the police were very agitated. They were being shot at by a murderer. And
who was this fellow Carpenter? Do we know anything about him?
I don't know much about him. No, he was infamous in the mid-50s in Chicago, apparently. But you also had a lot of police support units there, and you probably had bystanders who had come out to see what was going on once the police had grabbed him. You don't hear that noise in the shootout period, but you do hear it once he has been captured.
And the crowd screaming. Why is the crowd yelling in support of the criminal?
No, they're yelling because they're frightened. They're frightened.
Okay, sure.
Maybe
sure.
Somebody who was in that crowd will remember and will call up at 312-591-7200, but I think that's probably rather unlikely. Here's an interesting email. To what degree would you consider this era, that is the era that we've been sampling, quote, unregulated, meaning what was the role or influence of the FCC or its predecessor during that time?
Well, a lot of the documentary programming was initially in response, at least partially, to something called the Blue Book, which the Federal Communications Commission issued in 1946, basically saying broadcasting is too commercial. You need to demonstrate a greater commitment to public service. And so the networks, really in fear of increased regulation, started producing these programs. So in that sense, regulation did play a role, yes.
And you have to remember that the airwaves, in theory, belong to the people, and they are only licensed by these corporations that run network radio and local radio. And they have an obligation, in theory, to provide public service programming along with the big money-making as part of the agreement. And often they would not provide much, and this Blue Book in 46 is reminding them of their obligation.
Just really quickly, most of these programs that we've been playing, at least the network ones, were called sustaining programs. That means non-commercially sponsored.
I was wondering, how does this compare to what was happening in radio in our cousin countries, in, say, the UK or in Canada, or for that matter, countries speaking other languages, but in the Western European countries and so on. Did they do similar things in radio in those post-war years?
Well, there are certainly documentary traditions in British radio in a little bit later time period. I don't know enough about Canadian documentary history to talk about it with too much authority, but certainly there's been a long tradition of documentary work on the CBC in Canada and in other countries as well. You could argue that America has been somewhat lacking in terms of audio radio documentary compared with other countries, although there's been a resurgence in recent years, especially on public radio in this country.
You could also raise the question, what's the best way to tell the real news? Did doing docudrama sort of elaborations of important recent events give people a deeper and fuller understanding of what was happening in their world, or was it in some way turning reality too readily into theatricality?
That's a very good question. I think that compared to the short headline, two or three paragraph report on major event, and that's all you get, I think the docudramas are much more important in delivering the fuller perspective on whatever the event happens to be. And the fact that it's dramatized speaks a language that we who grew up in American culture are very familiar with. It's part of our currency. We're used to films. We're used to entertainment. We're used to excitement and Hollywood-esque influences in our communications. And indeed, this whole period of introspection and evaluation in the post-war years is not just radio. Motion pictures are doing it, too. If you think of movies like Knock on Any Door, about juvenile delinquency, Gentleman's Agreement, about anti-Semitism, Pinky, about racism toward African-Americans, these were entertainment vehicles with a message. The old line was, if you want to send a message, use Western Union. But motion pictures, radio, and certainly print were forms that were delivering messages, and it wasn't Western Union.
What messages do Hollywood films deliver these days? Well, beware of vampires.
They're still socially conscious filmmaking, and I assume always will be. It's when the commercial imperative does come into play that is going to create some conflicts. Just really quickly, there was actually a reviewer of an actuality program using actualities and recordings, and the reviewer said at that time, actually, a good dramatic director and good dramatic actors can get across reality much more effectively than recordings can. This was as of the late 1940s. Mm-hmm. So it's been a longstanding debate as to how best to get across public service and the reality of the world.
By the way, it might be pointed out by a talk show host that since those days in radio, another way to try to get at reality and some of the complex questions that agitate the world is talk radio and radio discussion.
Well, that goes back to the programs like the University of Chicago Roundtable, America's Town Meeting of the Year, where distinguished academics, critics, journalists, yeah, and other achievers come together to discuss topics that are you know, very, very important to the culture. And indeed, that tradition is still here today, although it is shrinking because it usually isn't a grabber. It doesn't bring in the dollars that a good screaming argument between mm-hmm, bigots on both sides. That's what makes for a boxing match.
Well, I would assert you can do more or less serious and interesting and even intelligent debate on radio.
That sheds light rather than heat.
One aspires to shed more light than heat, surely. And right now one aspires to take care of one's overdue responsibilities with regard to a commercial break, and then back to the phones, 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Here's an interesting email from a listener down in Louisville, Kentucky, Nick, who says, I was in Nashville on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and I heard a radio station air the entire CBS radio network broadcast day of June 6th, 1944. The recordings belonged to some collector who lived in Tennessee. I was transfixed. Listening to this programming was like going back in time. It was at least 14 hours of continuous air check. I only hope these recordings have been donated to a museum to be preserved for others to hear and study. I, for one, would love to hear it all again. I would guess that you had stuff like that in your collection.
It's very, very readily available commercially.
That one particular full
day? Yeah, in fact,
day?
When I was here last time, I played an excerpt from the beginning where the Germans, they didn't know if this was German propaganda or not, that the Americans had invaded. And it goes on for, 15, 20 hours of the CBS coverage, but it's on the internet. You can find it very easily. Uh-huh.
Yes, and does that include the George Hicks recording from?
No, not the attack.
Yeah, there's also a famous recording, one of the very early uses of recording technology in radio news, where George Hicks, who was a reporter for ABC and I think maybe other networks, is actually on the beach, I think at Omaha Beach, and did a recording of the actual invasion taking place, and that was, I think, picked up by all the networks.
Mm-hmm. He's actually on a ship offshore when the German airplane attacks them, and you can hear the anti-aircraft and everything going off.
And stuff of that sort can be easily found on internet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What would you enter as a search term? Just Radio World
D-Day War? CBS coverage, 1944.
Sure. Uh-huh. With that, back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Dan is next, or is it Don?
Don.
Good evening, Don.
Yes. I believe I heard you gentlemen mention local broadcasting earlier in the show.
Yes, sir.
I think there's one gentleman that deserves a mention, Franklin McCormick.
Well, he was a very famous figure on WGN Radio.
Yes, he certainly was.
Yeah.
You know, he was the only one that I ever heard of that actually read poetry on the air.
It's interesting you should say that, because we do programs on poetry occasionally, and we're just now we've just cast such a program. Indeed, it's scheduled for a particular date that I can't at the moment remember.
Well, I'll be darned. That's pretty good then, yeah. Well, you know, too, after Mr. McCormick died, I had the privilege of meeting him one time, but after he died, you recall who took his place?
Tell me.
Mike Rabchak.
Yes, and I knew Mike.
Came over from the television side,
right.
I believe.
Well, Mike Rabchak was still doing some part-time announcing on this radio station.
Yes.
When I started here, yes.
He had one of the most wonderful opening theme songs. It was Girl Talk.
Uh-huh.
And I've got Lord knows how many tapes I've got of him playing his music. You know, that's what's missing in radio, a good musical program.
Mm-hmm. Well, a number of people followed that same sort of format, though McCormick, I think, was very well known for it.
He was the dean of the Midnight Show.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a guy here, Paul Rogers, who did a very similar program. Paul, unfortunately, went to his reward, and he deserved considerable reward only about a year ago. But Paul was a staff announcer type and had been for many years. And then for quite a while, he was doing the program called Music from Chicago, I think, at night, before Steve and Johnny began doing their overnight program right here. Gentlemen, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Let's take one more quick call, at least, from Edna. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I was a child in New Jersey when the Orson Welles program came on.
Uh-huh.
And we knew that it was a play, because
actually,
they announced that before they started with the actual event.
So you didn't panic in New Jersey, even though the Martians landed, I think, at Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Exactly. But the funny thing is that when we were driving home, my parents and I,
yeah,
we were visiting my grandparents, my father was amazed at how heavy the traffic was, because it never was like that on a Sunday evening when we were going from my grandparents' to
everybody our home. Was rushing to the hills, were they?
Pardon?
They were rushing to the hills. Are you
they
trying to get out of?
They were. It was crazy. We didn't find out until later, of course, why the traffic was such a crazy situation.
But the panic was here in Chicago. In fact, one of the things that we gave to the Library of Congress was a headline from the Chicago Sun about the panic in Chicago over the War of the Worlds broadcast.
And, well, we were a little closer in New Jersey.
Well, that, you see, you had the advantage.
Well, it's a testament to the power of radio. When You Are There was on the air, they did the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, and they kept announcing during the program, you know, this is not real, but there were still people who were thinking that 1940s Italy was being buried in molten lava. So the radio really does have the power to capture the imagination that way.
It certainly does.
Well, ma'am, thank you.
Thank you.
Very glad to have shared those memories with you. Of course, we've all heard that many times. It's the single most commonly replayed old radio program, I would guess.
The War of the Worlds broadcast? Yeah. Oh, yes. Particularly the first 20 minutes or so when the space pods land and the monsters come out, and it's brought out in classic horror movie fashion, a little bit at a time, and then the monsters wade across in the Hudson into New York City, and the announcer drops a mic and is no longer heard. He dies, apparently.
2X2L calling CQ.
And then it becomes just a monologue with Wells.
Yeah.
It's almost the last man on Earth. But the... up in the 1980, I did a show on WBEZ here in Chicago, and I opened up my program on the Korean War with a 1950 broadcast saying the war is breaking out. We had people who actually thought war was breaking out in Korea all over again, even though the broadcast was from 1950.
What does that tell you?
Exactly what Professor just said, that indeed radio has a tremendous power, and that it better be used responsibly. In fact, I was told, make sure if you use that again, you announce that this is an old recording.
Yeah, going back again to You Are There, if you've seen any of the Walter Cronkite broadcasts from the 50s, they're very effective, but obviously it's television, it's much more literal. They had budget limitations, whereas with radio, you could reproduce history much more easily and effectively.
With that, gentlemen, we come to the end of the available time, and I do simply want to recommend to all who are listening the full, rich historical treatment of this period that you get in the new book by Matthew Ehrlich, that book titled Radio Utopia, Postwar Audio Documentary, in the Public Interest. He has been one of our guests, and Fred MacDonald, of course, has been as well, and we'll be with you again this Sunday night. Until then, if you want an Extension 720 fix, you can go to our website, WGNradio.com. WGNradio.com/extension720, where you find podcasts of recent programs and lots of classic podcasts going as far back, I think, as the 1980s. We recommend that to you as a great resource for downloading or for listening directly on a streaming basis. And with all of that, we will close down for the evening with thanks to all for listening and a most cordial good night.